It's time for another Internet Advisor Show podcast. Since 1998, we've been helping computer users get on the Internet, get around it, and get over the problems they encounter there. The Internet Advisor is a two-hour weekly radio program heard on WJR 760 AM in Detroit since 1998 and across the state of Michigan on the Michigan Talk Network. Now, here are your hosts with this week's Internet Advisor podcast.
Welcome to the Internet Advisor, your place for answers to your computer questions since 1998, with your co-hosts Gary Baker and Foster Brown and their team of tech experts. The door is always open at InternetAdvisor.net, on Facebook, and through Twitter. But right now it's time to get you in touch with your helpful hosts on this week's edition of Internet Advisor.
Very good afternoon to you, and welcome once again to another super-sized Internet Advisor. We're on from 3 until 6 o'clock this afternoon. We've got lots of great things to talk about this first hour. We'll be looking at malware and getting a handle on some of those nasty ones out there. We'll also be talking about Apple Computer, where it's heading, and Microsoft has a brand new application now for your smartphone that will help you when crisis strikes. Coming up this hour of the 3 hours of the Internet Advisor. Welcome to the Internet Advisor, Foster Brown. Mr. Eddie Rudell is with me in house today. Ed, so good to have you here.
It is great to be back after an extended week of being off.
And he isn't a figment of our imagination. Cal Carson is in studio. How are you doing, Cal?
This is amazing. And after a two-week hiatus, it really is good to be back here. I tell you, I have an addiction for this thing.
I know, isn't it? It's terrible.
It's crazy. And when you're gone away from it so long, you just start to quiver a bit. And, you know, you walk by a radio and you start to shake. You know, it's just really weird.
My wife has accused me of being, you know, addicted like that, too. And matter of fact, I told people that I'd be the kind of person who would take a little piece of cardboard and write, "We'll broadcast for food," and stand on a corner someplace. It's terrible, folks. It is an addiction that I suffered from for nearly 40 years right now. Guys, we got it. What a big week going on. And today, a big program again. You guys, by the way, happy anniversary. I know talked to you on the phone, but now in person. I'm sorry, the cake is gone. That evaporated.
You know, it's really good that it works that way because it's non-fattening.
That's right. It certainly is. But I'm delighted. Now, think back 15 years ago where you were and what you were doing and, you know, what was going on in technology for you, Eddie?
15 years ago was a lot busier.
1998.
Well, we were rolling out Windows 98 and big upgrade from, the Windows 95.
That's true.
And a plug-and-play operating system.
Okay.
What else? Safe mode was introduced and probably...
Wow.
I can't think of anything
else. We take for granted, particularly dealing with malware nowadays.
Yeah. Safe mode was very... Yeah, because we were upgrading people from Windows 3.1 who skipped 95 and went right to 98.
That's kind of been typical, hasn't it, with Microsoft operating systems.
They were still Windows for work groups back then. And
but when a Microsoft system changed like 98, it was groundbreaking.
Yes.
Huge. Cal, how about you?
You know, it's funny because, you know, you said the Windows 98 and that sort of thing. That was like the time when Mac OS 8 was out as well. So I was pretty much messing with those sort of things. And
Which one of the cats would that have been?
Or was there were no cats.
There were no cats then.
No.
What we're referring to, by the way, folks, are the nicknames that have been given to the Apple operating system.
I thought those were desserts. Oh, I'm sorry. That's Android.
That's Android.
Yeah. It wasn't until the 10 series that the kiddies started to come out the bag.
Oh, was it? Oh, okay. Okay.
Oh, okay. Prior to that, it was just numbers. I started when it was Mac OS 6, or it was called System 6, and then it went to OS 7, and then 8, and then 9, and then the cat came out of the bag with 10.
What have been the biggest changes since those days, 15 years ago, with OS 8? I mean, it's such
OS
a
8,
radically different?
That was OS 7. That was actually on like 7 floppies.
Wow.
For the operating system. And those weren't 1.4 floppies. Those were like, you know...
The big floppies.
The 720 floppies. No, they were the little guys.
Oh, the little guys. Okay. Yeah, the 720s. Yes.
Yeah, but the little 720 capacity floppies. Yeah. And I think the actual operating system was on the first 2.5 floppies, and the rest of it was all like accessories and print drivers and stuff like that went with it.
Yeah, it sounds familiar.
And nowadays, it's a download.
Yep. A Mountain Lion was a download, and it was like 30, was it 30 bucks?
$29.95.
Well, even Windows 8 is a download. I mean,
yes,
systems, now that we're going to tablets and ultralights, don't even include CD media. You download and install into a USB media or install...
I think some of the biggest changes have been that we no longer like use those coffee cup holders that are on our desktops.
Yeah,
those things called CD trays. You know, they're just not part of it. Optical drives really aren't part of most systems. Although, if you have one that's been around for 3 or 4 years, you've got one, obviously.
Right.
But the new systems aren't incorporated at all.
Blu-ray? I mean, even the gaming systems still have those. Blu-rays and DVD players.
That's true.
I mean, slowly
speaking,
on the way
in terms
out.
Of consumer, way yeah, out. If you're going to tablets and all these lightweight things.
But even the Mac OS comes shipping. I mean, its bootable media is a USB flash drive, isn't it?
Well, you can put it on.
It used to be. Yeah. Even that's not there. Well, you can still get it that way.
Yeah, I back mine
but
up.
But you don't
on
have
it,
to get it that way. It all comes over the wire, which is really funny because there was some years back, Larry Ellison, the guy who is in charge of Oracle.
Oracle, pardon me.
He had a phobia back then. He thought everything should come over the wire. He used to say it was really crazy to take bits and bytes, put them on a plastic disk, put them into a box, sell them to a person to take them off the disk, put them back into the computer, and put them in electronic form. He says everything should go across the wire, and it looks like he was right.
That's right.
Well, but we had to wait for the infrastructure. We had to wait the 10 or 15 years for the infrastructure to catch up.
That's
You know what I'm seeing, and I don't know if you guys agree with this, but it seems to me that as I look at computers that are out right now, we'll talk a little bit later in the show about the fact that, like with the Microsoft Surface Pro, it's a relatively small hard drive, relatively small hard drives now that are the SSD, the solid state drives. In other words, they're very fast, small, not a lot of capacity on them, but you're expected to save a lot of your stuff to the cloud. So you're talking about the cloud being a big change. Mm-hmm. The other thing I think is we're shrinking the size of the hard drives on computers, the portable ones at least.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other thing too is that now the hybrid drives are starting to come on as a economic choice because you can't really get a really large capacity SSD drive. But if you get a hybrid drive where it has one part of it is SSD, another part is mechanical, the mechanical is normally where you would store stuff that you don't usually use that much,
mm-hmm.
and you use the SSD portion for fast booting and fast processing and swap files.
Right, and they definitely have their place. But one of the things I noticed is that manufacturers are concerned about battery life.
Oh,
and with these solid-state drives, now that we have these things, you gain an additional hour, if not more, 2 hours when you have solid-state.
The
as
other
opposed
thing, too,
to,
is our computers are more and more mobile. They're portable.
Yes.
We're taking
lighter.
These things with us. They're lighter, smaller, and our phones really have the computing capacity that 15 years ago we would count on a big desktop having.
This is true.
And a lot more storage in terms of RAM and everything else. Hey, folks, coming up in just a moment, we're going to talk with somebody, great guest here a while back when I was on vacation, so I get to talk to him too. Marcin Kleshinsky, the guy who founded Malwarebytes. Talking about malware and getting rid of it. Welcome back to the Internet Advisor, Foster Brown. Gary Baker is off today with his son. They're up north having some fun skiing. Where the snow is still snow, hasn't changed.
I want to join that Boy Scout troop.
Yeah.
Did they go skiing?
Yeah, I like that. And also with us, Cal Carson in studio. But you guys, a while back when I was on vacation, matter of fact, last summer, had a chance to talk with a gentleman. I loved the interview. It was fascinating. Marcin Kleshinsky, who is the founder of Malwarebytes, was with you, and he is with us once again. Marcin, thanks so much for joining us here on the Internet Advisor.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us again. I was telling the guys, I just enjoyed the daylights of that last conversation that you guys had, and so glad that you could join us again. Hey, Marcin, one of the reasons we wanted to have you on is a while back, you folks took a look ahead at the year 2012 at some of the things that were going to be facing people, and you were talking about some of the things coming up. One of the things that we've been finding a lot of people running into, both in our email and our call-ins, are these ransomware. Where suddenly they find their computer held up and literally held for ransom. You're supposed to pay this amount of money, whether it's the FBI or Microsoft. Is this a fairly new development, or why is it we're seeing more of it now?
Yeah, nothing's changed. That's the scary part. This is something that has been plaguing us from when I came aboard the security community in 2007, right? I mean, the last discussion we had was pretty much me describing kind of how Malwarebytes was formed, and it was because of this exact threat. It's just getting worse. nowadays they're actually calling your cell phone telling you, you know, we're from Microsoft, we're from this company, and your computer's infected.
Yes.
Let us help you and give us $150, and you're supposed to fall for that.
How does that work? People are asking me.
How do they get your phone number?
How do I get my phone number?
You know, your guess is as good as mine.
Right.
Presumably, you know, you sign up for a service that's a little bit shady, they sell your information. Or, you know, numbers are not that hard to just dial and try, right?
Right.
So
right. They can just keep on random dialing. Or they may have a way of finding out from something that you clicked, you liked on Facebook or heaven knows where else. That leads me to question, because I've had people ask me as well, I did nothing wrong. I have, you know, good, let's say, Microsoft Security Essentials on Windows 7. I'm pretty well protected, and I have my malware bytes in the kit as well. But they said, all of a sudden, I was surfing the net, and suddenly it popped up. It seems to happen when you're online. How does that work?
Well, there's a couple of things, right? There's a couple of vectors of attack, if you will. Social engineering is definitely one of them. You infect one of, you know, one of your Facebook friends, that messages get sent out through the Facebook Messenger to all of their friends and then to all of their friends and so on.
Yeah.
And it's just a chain effect of people getting infected, clicking links, you know, hey, I found some pictures of you. That sounds convincing. You're going to click that. And then it's going to say, here, download the pictures. Oh, sure. You know, that's even more convincing. And the chain effect continues. Back to what I was saying a little bit about the Microsoft, you know, Microsoft's never going to call you. If you get a call from Microsoft saying, we need $150 to clean your PC, hang up right away.
Yep.
Same goes with email, you know, same goes with pop-ups. They're not that proactive in trying to reach out to their customers and tell them they're infected. That just doesn't happen, you know, in this world.
How about your internet service provider? Because we've had a number of users that have called us and said, hi, I'm from Comcast, and we've detected that you have a virus, and we'd like to work with you to get that removed, and premium support would cost such and such dollar amount. You know, it's so, probably the same thing.
Yeah, that one is a little bit more legitimate. Internet service providers do monitor their networks to see who may or may not be infected. If there's a computer that's sending traffic, they can trace it back to the address.
Okay. So they may be... Go ahead.
Yeah, if they call you, make sure they know your name, your address, you know, your last bill, something to verify that you're actually talking to a Comcast support representative.
Yeah, they know.
Don't just say, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I'm glad you brought that up.
Now, Marcin, one of the things I want to talk to you about, though, is that, say, for instance, somebody, you know, has got their machine, you know, clean and protected, and it's got malware bytes on there, as I said, but they just go to, let's say, Google and search for something, and suddenly the place they go to is infected, and they end up getting... How does that work out with... But is there a connection between search engines sometimes and the results you get and the way that you can get infected?
Absolutely. I mean, you can search for the New York Times, go on the New York Times website at the wrong day, on the wrong hour, the wrong minute, and it could be infected.
Ouch.
There was a case about, you know, 6 months back where the New York Times actually had advertising that was serving malware to their customers. They pulled it down very quickly, but you can you know, assume that a couple of people got infected. And even that kind of safe habit, doing nothing wrong, surfing to the New York Times, got people infected without the right protection.
Mm.
Hey, Marcin, I got a question for you. I mean, I love a freebie as much as the next guy, but tell me, because I got to know, what's the big difference in me using your free malware bytes and using your $25 version, which I love the idea that you only pay once and it's good for life?
Sure. So when I founded the company, you know, it wasn't what we were doing, it's why we were doing it. It was helping people because we were, you know, victims ourselves. And so we offer free malware removal, scanning removal, all of that, you know, to you, because we believe that you don't need malware on your system. We, you know, we don't want to charge you for that.
Right.
You didn't get charged to get the malware, of course. Our full version, the pro version that we consider, when we sell for $25, is basically real-time protection. And we don't try to, you know, stuff that in your face and say, you need to buy this. We understand that people go, try our free version, the malware gets removed, and then it clicks in their mind, you know, hey, this helps me remove the malware. Maybe it'll stop it from coming back.
So you've become you then have become an antivirus company as well.
No, we have not.
Okay.
So we still are a complementary tool. We are there to be a crutch for your antivirus because we understand that your antivirus cannot do it itself.
So how does your pro version work with, let's say, my Avast or my Microsoft Security Essentials or whatever?
Completely compatible and very lightweight on resources. We've designed it to do exactly that.
Well, isn't antivirus different from malware anyway? Or is there a difference?
That's a good question. Back in the 90s, there were things called viruses. And tons of antiviruses came out of the woodwork and said, we are an antivirus. We protect you from this thing that destroys your machine.
Right.
Nowadays, things are malicious software, malware, things that spy on your computer, steal your data, bring up rogue advertising that makes you, you know, goads you into purchasing a product. And so when we came on the scene in 2008, we called ourselves an anti-malware, staying ahead of the game and going after these threats that your antivirus just cannot catch. We are very good at zero-day heuristics, meaning even before the malware writer picks up their keyboard and starts writing the code for the malware, we've already detected it, which is, you know, just excellent to hear.
Now you got a crystal ball? How in the world do you do that?
Well, they're not very smart people, so it's easy to predict, you know, what their attacks are going to be and what they're trying to do.
And that's what you look for. You look for those patterns. I got to quickly ask you because we're almost out of time here, but what's your favorite, I mean, besides your product, obviously, are there other ones that you like that are good antivirus systems that are out there that you recognize as worthy competitors?
All right, so... Without kind of, you know, saying that they're my favorite.
I don't want you to endorse somebody else, no. But, I mean, just, you know, some other ones.
Sure. So I've used Avast on my parents' computers. I've used ESET on my parents' computers. And I think that Microsoft is starting to do a much better job being proactive against these threats. So let's leave it at those three.
Yeah. Perfect, because, you know, we've come to pretty much the same conclusion.
That's, you are confirming exactly what we had come to
It's really good to hear that from a professional.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, and what I like about yours is that that you really catch the ones that other people don't. And I guess the idea with the pro version is, folks, that you bring that same skill to catch those other ones that folks haven't gotten to an active, you know, you're not just going in now and removing something surgically. You're protecting them as a barrier there for that as well. Well, Marcia, how have things been going for you? How's the company been growing?
Awesome. I mean, we've been going, you know, growing excellently. I mean, we just opened a new office in San Jose, new researchers, basically people that have come from the community that have been helping people for free, and we're just like, you know, can we pay you?
Yeah. Hey, listen, it used to be a few of you guys in a box of pizza. How many have you got right now? How many employees?
60 or 70. Yeah.
Oh, excellent.
that's a lot of pizza.
A lot of pizza.
How is it for you being like a boss of a company like that versus, you know, just having the gang?
I'm not a boss. I'm here to do exactly what they're doing, get my hands dirty, and, you know, and help people out, just like my researchers are, my developers, and so on.
Well, Marcin, you're doing a great job, and it's been a delight talking to you. Marcin Klasinski, founder of Malware Bytes, and you've heard it. It's good stuff. We certainly will endorse it for you as well. Yeah. Marcin, thanks so much for being with us here on the Internet Advisor.
Thanks for having me, guys.
All right. Bye now. By the way, that's MikeMalwareBytes.org. You can find that. Back in just a minute to talk about Apple. It's a great day to be with you here on the Internet Advisor. Foster Brown, co-host along with Ed Riddell and Cal Carson. But it certainly hasn't been a good day for a lot of people to our far east on the East Coast, where Snowmageddon, some people have been saying, has hit there. Over 2 feet of snow in some places, winds of hurricane force, people without power, isolated. It is a tragedy that has happened in many places along the East Coast, and they've been hit with Hurricane Sandy and a lot of other stuff that's going out there. Where do you turn in a tragedy? How can you reach out to people and help them? Say, for instance, the folks on the East Coast right now. Well, Microsoft has come up with a fascinating answer to that question. And with us to talk about that right now is James Rooney, who is a Microsoft executive, who is here to talk about the Help Bridge app. James, thanks so much for being with us here on the Internet Advisor.
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yes, thank you. Now, I know you are involved in Microsoft's Technology for Good program, so we know that this is out there to help do good. Exactly how does this smartphone application help people to do good when people are in disasters?
Yeah, sure. So it's a mobile app, like you say, that is meant to really connect people to those they care about most in times of disaster. But it also helps them find donation opportunities and volunteer opportunities, both locally and nationwide.
Okay, so it's a way of us getting in touch with the people we know of. Let's say, for instance, on the East Coast who may be stranded and without power, and then also finding a way of helping by donating to, what, to the organizations that are helping them. Can you name some of the ones that you could donate through this application?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it's most of the big disaster relief organizations. It's the American Red Cross, Save the Children, World Vision, all the organizations that, that really are on the ground immediately after a disaster strikes.
So how do people donate through the application?
Yeah, we try to make it pretty simple. There's a few different ways that people can give. There's a text to give, which is as simple as sending a little SMS button, and smaller donations of $5 or $10. Mm-hmm. You can donate via PayPal, an API we have with PayPal, so that way they can donate for larger amounts, $100, $200, and so on. And then we also partner with a couple other nonprofits, one that has a listing of what goods are needed in an emergency disaster zone. So you can understand, do they need jackets, tents, socks, right. And so you can send the goods that are appropriate. And then lastly, there is the opportunity to find volunteer opportunities near wherever a disaster has hit.
Yeah. Jack Kell?
Yeah. Is this a straight-out donation from the individuals, or is Microsoft doing any sort of matching or anything like that for every donation that you make?
It is straight from the individuals. Microsoft is trying not to get in the middle of their donations right. to their organizations that they care about. But we do, at Microsoft, we have a long history of helping out in disaster and humanitarian relief situations where we partner with local organizations, nationwide organizations, and we, you know, provide software support services and cash donations as appropriate.
Sure, without a doubt. And the only reason why I brought that up is because a lot of times people are more motivated to give if they know they're doing double the need as opposed to single the need.
Right, definitely. Yeah, that definitely does motivate folks for sure when there is some kind of match. And we try, when Microsoft tries to get, when we get involved with disaster relief efforts in terms of cash and other donations, you know, we try to, instead of spreading it out across multiple organizations, we try to select a couple that are really big in the area that are strategic partners of ours. So
okay.
We try to keep our giving separate from the users of the tab.
Yeah,
that's
and
great.
Certainly the ones you know of are really worthy ones. Now, let's step back in. By the way, James Rooney is with us. He's the program manager for Microsoft's Technology for Good program. We're talking about Help Bridge app. It's an application, in other words, that you can put down on your smartphone. Now, what platforms do you support, the phone platforms?
Yeah, it's on Windows Phone, iOS, and Android. So pretty much, you know, those three platforms, right. we're covering the most amount of people.
Okay. And by the way, folks, if you simply go to internetadvisor.net and click on the Help Bridge, that word that's in blue on the screen there, it'll take you to the corporate citizenship page for Microsoft, and there you'll find out more details about this Help Bridge app, and how you can download it to your phone. Now, you mentioned that there's a part of this that is also a way of getting in touch with people who've been affected by disasters. How does it work to do that?
Yeah, so we really see this app as a key part of individuals' disaster preparation activities. And so what happens is when you open up the app for the first time, you can create a little emergency contact group. So, you know, if it's your parents, your sister, your neighbors, right. whatever, you can add them to an emergency contact group so that when a disaster strikes, with a click of just a couple of buttons, you can send off an email and an SMS to those people, and you can also post a message on your Facebook wall. And you, most importantly, I think, you have the opportunity to include your location as well.
Mm, okay.
Oh, your GPS location. So
yeah, that's correct.
So you can actually say, I'm okay, or I need help.
That's correct, yeah. There's two options, and then there's a little text box where you can add some more context if you need to.
Oh, excellent. I see. So, thanks for saying that, Ed, because it's not just for looking out for... It was interesting. Leo Laporte was saying that his mother lived in Providence, Rhode Island, mm-hmm. and they've been clobbered by this superstorm that came through. So he could go looking for her. He could send her a message. But you've got a very good point. If his mom could also, with this application, then say, I'm here, I'm okay, or right. I need help.
And notify through social networks and, like you said, text messages to 20, 30 family members. I have a big family. And Facebook for all my people that follow me as well. And it says, I'm okay, thanks for caring, or I need help, and provide GPS coordinates. Great idea.
James, has this been tried out in the field under disaster situations?
Not yet. We individuals might be using it now. We are definitely kind of trying to track what kind of messages are sent, just in terms of, like, you know, our SMSs being sent, our emails, our donations being made, just to see if people are using this. You know, over the last couple of days, we have seen a spike in downloads. So I'm hoping that people up in the Northeast are downloading this and using it to send messages to their friends and family.
Yeah, that would be tremendous to see the impact this is having. Be interesting to follow the impact of this with this kind of a storm that's out there, where people are literally buried and trying to dig themselves out without power and a lot of other stuff. Why did Microsoft get involved in developing this?
Yeah, so as I mentioned earlier, you know, we have a long history in disaster relief efforts. And, you know, over the past couple of disasters, so, you know, with Katrina and Japan and Haiti and all that, what we'd see are technologies kind of spin up after those disasters to do these two things, to help people connect with each other and to help people more easily get involved, either donating or whatever. But they tended to be either specific to one organization or to a region or to a disaster. And so, and you know, and they'd kind of fade away, and the next disaster would come and we'd see the same thing. So we thought, you know, is there something that we could build that would be appropriate for any disaster in any area, you know, across multiple communication paths, so that way it can just be there and ready to use when a disaster strikes.
That is,
you know, and it's a great idea, because you could very easily, so many people want to help, but they just don't know how to help. So if you had 20 or 30 friends, and basically your house was, your roof just collapsed because of snow, and you say, I need help, and you post a little message, you could have 20 or 30 friends or even extended people that say, you know what, don't pay for a hotel. Come on over our place. We got a warm meal, a warm bed for you and the kids.
Yep.
Come on over.
That's
you may not make that personal phone call, but people will reach out to you.
You know, it's interesting, James, you mentioned that I remember after Haiti, the Twitter networks that sprang up and ham radio operators who were helping with that disaster area. And pardon me, with that disaster that had happened. And here you're saying that essentially it's kind of a if we put this on our smartphones now, we may not have to use it right away. Mm-hmm. But it would be a great thing to have, as you said, Ed, in the case of a disaster. Go ahead, James.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, I'm in kind of a funny situation that I hope nobody ever has to use this app.
Yes. You know? Yeah. Right. Right.
You know, because you know, we just want to make sure that people are prepared, so that if a disaster does strike, that, you know, they have the tools they need to be able to kind of get in touch and help out if they can.
Yeah, folks, think about it this way: it's absolutely free. It runs on Windows. It runs on the Android. It runs on
the iPhone.
On the iPhone as well, iOS devices. You know, think of it as like a fire extinguisher or a first aid kit. It's just really good to have. And then, if you want to help some of the people who are hurt by disasters, it's a great way to safely give to those organizations that are helping. Another great job here, James. Thanks so much for being with us.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
All right. That's James Rooney, who is the program manager for Microsoft's Technology for Good program. Again, simply go to internetadvisor.net and click on that link for the Help Bridge application. When we come back in the next hours, it's going to be all fun and games for good causes. Stay tuned. Hour number two of the Internet Advisor is ahead. You're listening to a podcast of the Internet Advisor Show. If you want to see the show notes for this program, visit our homepage at internetadvisor.net. That's where you'll also find past podcasts, our toolkit full of free software to clean up your computer and keep it running strong, and other resources. If you have a question for our hosts, just click the contact form on the homepage or enter our forums and place your question there. You can also friend us on Facebook. Now let's get back to the second hour of the Internet Advisor Show podcast. Welcome aboard. It's hour number two of the Internet Advisor, our special edition today. 3 hours long. We're going to be here this hour talking about gaming for good. That's right. These people are online. They're having a whole bunch of fun and gaming in other circumstances, but they are reaching out to help people with their gaming. And then we'll also be talking with Rich Yaroslavsky from Bloomberg News about all the hot news going on. Microsoft Surface Pro launch, Dell going private, and even HP coming out with a Chromebook. So glad you decided to join us here. We've got Cal Carson in studio with us. Mr. Cal Carson, good to have you with us.
Always a pleasure.
Our Jedi Master of the Apple.
It's the place I treasure.
You will come over to my side.
I did. Ed Rudell is also here.
Still rocking a PC.
That's right. Maybe that'll become the dark side from now on. And we have Shane Hamlin in studio. Hi, Shane. How are you?
How are you? I made it in. I heard there was more cake. No?
No, more cake? I'm sorry. That evaporated. Last week, you got to taste some of the anniversary cake.
Yes, I did. It was good.
These guys didn't.
Nope.
it's a been kind of a weight measure, you know, to save them from weight.
I might have some in my bag here somewhere.
No. We're watching our girlish figure over here.
Well, Shane, you brought somebody with you for our program, and I forgot the first half of our program. I'm delighted that Zach Weigel is back. Hi, Zach. How you doing?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
Give us a little idea of who Zach is and how he's
a couple months ago, we had Zach on. He is the founder of Gamers Outreach Foundation. It is a foundation of group of gamers that have gotten together and do events like the coming event that we're going to talk about shortly, Gamers for Giving 2013. And they provide services. I don't think it's concentrated on just one particular charity. I think they spread it out. And Zach can tell us a little bit more in depth on what that is.
Kind of a thumbnail, because I know we've had you on before talking about it, but just a thumbnail of how this started and what the Gamer Outreach is.
Yeah, crash course overview. So I started up when I was in high school, tried to put together a video game tournament for the peers at my school, and it got shut down. So by someone who thought that video games were corrupting the minds of America's youth, like we discussed last time. And so my buddies and I ended up putting together a new tournament for charity. And our first event was actually called Gamers for Giving 2008. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we raised $4,000 for a local chapter of the Autism Society of America.
Wonderful.
And then after the event was a success, personally, you know, I thought to myself, wow, this is really cool. I have been a video gamer for a long time. I'd like to continue this on. And so over time, we developed our own initiatives, and now we build these portable video game carts for children's hospitals. So if kids are stuck in bed for long periods of time, a nurse can wheel an Xbox room to room and kids can play video games. And then we also send video game care packages to troops overseas. So if you know guys are in Afghanistan or overseas right now, we'll hook them up with games from back home.
Oh, that is really sweet. That's a wonderful outreach. Now, you've been going on for – this will be your fifth year, am I right?
Yeah,
your
fifth year we're getting.
Yeah. Wonderful. Where will it be taking place?
It's going to happen at Eastern Michigan University Student Center in Ypsilanti, February 16th and 17th. And we're hosting a Halo tournament, a Call of Duty tournament, what's called a BYOC LAN party, so people come in with their own computers, their own Xboxes.
Bring your own computer.
You know, if you've never seen it, here's the thing. I've heard it was sold out.
The LAN part. Yeah.
If you've never witnessed this, even if you're not into gaming and if you're in the area and you want to stop by and just donate to the charity or just swing by and take a look at things, you'd be amazed at what these guys do. They set up almost like a camp, like deer camp, but for gaming.
Yeah.
I mean, they've got their lights going and it's quite a
Mountain Dew. We got the Doritos,
your Red Bull. You've got it all.
Yeah. Now, how many people? If it's sold out, how many gamers?
There would be 406 on-site attendees throughout the weekend. That's not including like our staff and volunteers.
That's
like that.
Awesome.
Now, here's the question that comes to mind. You mentioned that you guys get up games together and ship them over to the guys overseas that are defending the country and taking care of that sort of thing. I normally play a game when I want to get away from what I normally do every day. So if they're like doing
not first
military
person shooters,
stuff,
I don't think
yeah.
so.
Yeah, are they all like playing Farmville or something?
No, you know, honestly, that's actually a question we get now and again. And honestly, a lot of those guys want to play video games just, you know, as we all do normally. They want to come back and play Call of Duty. Yeah. There's a great documentary, Restrepo, actually. Mm-hmm. It was about some guys, I think in Afghanistan, they were in these mountains fighting terrorists. And there's a scene in that film where they were back at camp and they're playing Call of Duty against each other on their PSPs.
Call of Duty, by the way, for who don't know, is kind of a military multiplayer game.
First-person shooter?
Oh, it's a first-person shooter game.
Correct. And the thing is that they say, I mean, it sharpens your reflexes. I mean, it keeps them sharp. Keeps their mind sharp.
I don't know. I've been pretty sharp when I found that little sheep behind that cabbage in Farmville the other day. And I was doing great.
You got to harvest your carrots. Yeah.
That's why you're not over in Afghanistan defending us.
You're absolutely
that
right.
I'm much safer for that.
But I make a marvelous coleslaw.
Go ahead.
I will say this, though. I mean, most of our troops, they're young of age.
Yes.
They're all gamers. Yes. They love, and that's the one thing they miss when they leave home. Is getting together with their friends and gaming. And that's a great service that Zach and Gamers Outreach provides for our troops.
Yeah, that's because the most important thing when it comes to the bottom line is, are we doing something to give those guys some sort of relief, give them a little touch of home so that they feel comfortable while they're out doing what they're doing?
Actually how the initiative started because the woman had started up. Her husband was overseas, and he was coming home with a lot of toiletries and things that were obviously necessary, but they just had an abundance of.
Yeah.
So she wanted to do something different, and her thought was, well, my husband plays video games. I'm sure he'll appreciate this. And went from just sending him games to sending all of his buddies games. And it is something that they go back to, I think, to just relax and have fun.
I mean, back in the day, what was it? The USO, was it? Yes, that's right. Yes, I mean, that's, yeah, that kind of provided the entertainment for the troops. But, you know, Bob Hope ain't doing that much anymore.
You know, and Foster doesn't sing like he used to. No, so, you know, we know how that works.
So this kind of works out for them. I mean, that's kind of what they enjoy doing. And they, I've seen it, you know, in Afghanistan. Well, they set up these gamer tents. And there's, you know, there's a tent and there's, you know, five or six Xboxes or PS3s or whatever, you know, wow, you have
in
there.
It's a great recruiting tool, actually.
Well, yeah, and they're also doing, I don't think they should do training, I think.
Well, a while ago, the U.S. Army actually, and it's still going, used to put out America's Army. And that was a free game for kids to play, and they would recruit off of the America's Army. If you were good at that game, you probably were good in the field.
Boy, oh, it sounds like the last Starfighter movie.
Yeah, just like that.
Zach Weigel is with us, and matter of fact, we're going to stick around, okay? We want to talk more about gaming. Shane Hamlin is in studio along with Cal Carson and Ed Riddell, myself. And by the way, thanks to the folks behind the glass, Scott Iometta, Rich Lisinski, and Annie Nichols, our lady of the phone calls. We'll be back in just a minute to talk more about gaming. I don't know if we could call this the Boys with Toys segment, but we've been talking about gaming and getting a lot of energy in this room. If we could tap it, we probably could light some of the eastern cities that are without power right now. We have in studio, of course, our folks, our team of experts who are here, and that is Ed Riddell, Cal Carson, and Shane Hamlin.
Yes.
Shane has brought a guest along, and that's Zach Weigel, who is with the Gamers Outreach Foundation. You can get to that, by the way, by clicking off of Zach's name, which is a live link on our homepage. But the Gamers for Giving 2013 is an event that you're going to be putting on at Eastern Michigan University, where you're a senior, right?
Yep.
Okay, and again, what are the dates for that?
February 16th and 17th, so next weekend.
February 16th and 17th.
Yep. And you can go to gamersoutreach.org for the information.
Yep.
And, you know, even like I said earlier, if you're not a gamer, there's things to do there, right, Zach?
Yeah, we have a lot of free play activities. There's some spectating that can go on. If you've never seen one of these events, it's kind of a
You're talking about in
experience.
The auditorium there.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. So we rent out the Grand Ballroom at Eastern Student Center.
Oh, wow.
And so on one side of the room, we host the LAN party. On the other side of the room, we have this Call of Duty Halo 4 tournament happening. We have some booths from some of our sponsors that set up some activities for people to partake in. We'll be streaming the event live through a website called twitch.tv. So if you go to
twitch.tv. I love it.
Yeah, twitch.tv/LANFest.
So streaming it. So go twitch.tv. Okay.
Yeah, it's actually, we have some professional video gamers coming in from different parts of the industry. There's a guy named Alex Rodriguez. He goes by Axel Toss. He's a professional StarCraft 2 commentator.
Mm-hmm.
No.
So he actually casts StarCraft 2 matches. So we'll have these guys live on camera. It's kind of a mini production, right? Kind of grassroots.
You know, folks, one of the things you have to really get, this is an enormous industry. Do you have any figures on the size of the gaming industry?
How about this? Bigger than the movie industry.
Okay. Just the,
just to give you an example.
Holy.
I mean, it's huge. And we can, without getting too geeked out here, we can talk about games for the whole show. I mean, we can go on and on and on and on because.
But I think it's good to give people a size, a sense of the proportion of this.
It's a big industry.
So, you know, I did one thing. I just didn't realize it was that large. So when all these high school kids say that I'm going to go to college and get into gaming, you know, where and I'm going to make that my profession, they're really not blowing smoke, are they?
No.
No, it's a good field.
One of the interesting things about the video game industry, too, is there are a lot of opportunities to get involved with the industry, aside from just making games. I mean, there's every position you can think
there's
of.
There's marketing,
exists.
Communication.
I can tell you from voice acting, that is I've done some, that voice acting is an enormous field. There are people who have made fortunes being the voice in, well, like a little girl in a game or an evil overlord or something like that.
A demon.
It's, yeah, whatever. They make a ton of money doing that kind of thing. Cal?
Okay, so this function that you're having, age-wise, cost-wise, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. So it's $25 per person to compete in the tournaments. The LAN is now sold out, which was also $25. And that lasts all weekend. So the event goes nonstop from the morning of Saturday to the night of Sunday evening overnight.
A lot of sleeping in the lobbies.
Yeah, people will bring sleeping bags. They bring blow-up mattresses. Things like that.
By the way, is this co-sponsored by Airwick?
Airwick?
The deodorizer?
No.
No, we need to get in touch with those guys.
Febreze,
there you go.
I was going to say Febreze. I was going to bring that. I was going to say, you know, Rite Aid or Ban, you know.
Rite Guard,
there you go.
Sponsored by Rite Guard.
And I know gaming like goes the gambit, but, you know, is there an age guidance that for this particular thing? Because some games are wide open, as you know. Some of them are closed. Right. I don't know how you guys are going to handle it. But, you know, is it like a family-type situation?
Yeah,
or
can I bring my
more
8-year-old grandson?
So, yeah, well, here's the thing. We have parental consent forms for any attendees that are 18 and below. Okay. And even if you're, there's, I think it's like 13 or 14 is the cutoff limit. But if you're younger than that, you have to be accompanied by a parent at all times.
Okay.
So our thinking is that there are games, obviously, that are rated M. And those games are typically
that means
mature. I'm sorry.
Okay. But folks, you should know that the gaming industry has a code, right?
It has a rating system, yeah. So it kind of will try to help parents out to figure out what kind of content is in games that may or may not be age appropriate. You know, appropriate for their
just
child.
Just quickly, what are those ratings for? This is the course. I'm sorry, yeah. I'm a grandpa. My grandson came over to play, and he wanted to play a certain game, which is Minecraft. I had never heard of it before. I'm sorry, but
okay.
I checked it out, and it's a great. It gets a very good rating.
Mm-hmm.
Kid friendly.
I mean, you have everyone for E for everyone, and
okay.
M for mature, and you have, and it will give you just like the movie industry. It'll give you your ages appropriate for
okay.
each.
Just so people are aware of that when they're
a lot of games are rated M. Mature, and they're really, it's not, they're not that bad, but there's, you know, some violence and stuff like that, and, you know, and that's, it works.
Yeah, but is it any different than what they watch when they're watching
no.
TV?
No.
And when I, when I go out to buy Christmas gifts for my kids, and it was violent, I proof the game, mm-hmm. and
well,
and
but I think
make
that's
a decision.
That's the point. You really need to proof it, and that's why I try to do the due diligence with my grandson. I didn't wind up saying, yeah, because kids can get sucked into these games, and there can be inappropriate content, or you can end up spending a lot of money. Cal?
Yeah.
If you're really interested in those rating systems, you can go to esrb.org, and they have all those rating systems out there and explains exactly what they are, and you can go down that list just in case you might want to know.
So there is a lot of people watching going on at these events.
There is, yeah. I mean, the event is free for spectators, so people just want to come and hang out and see what the event is about.
Do people come, like, dressed up as characters in the
You know,
game?
Actually, the last time we did this event, we had some guy dressed up. As one of his characters. I can't remember what character it was, but at some of the larger conventions in the video game industry, I mean, our event, we'll have like 400 to 500 people, you know, like I said earlier, but the events where you see like thousands and thousands, they have a lot of what are called cosplayers, and the people will dress up.
Cos in costume.
Yeah.
Yep. And so you're going to have Master Sergeant show up and Boba Fett. And, oh, that'd be awesome.
Zach Weigel is... Yes, guess which one he was. Zach Weigel's with us from Gamers Forgiving. We're talking something about that as well, along with the other guys in studio here. You know, there's kind of a stereotypical image of the gamer being this geek, you know, who lives in his parents' basement, and we teased about, you know, drinking Mountain Dew and eating Doritos. Tell me a little bit.
Yeah, as I sit here with my Red Bull.
Yeah.
Really?
Welcome to radio where you
Come
can
on.
See it all.
Let me add Red Bull to that, too. Is that a fair characterization? How would you characterize yourself and your generation playing games?
Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, there are a lot of different stereotypes that exist around the video game industry. One of the things that's being talked about right now, especially with some of the shootings, is like, you know, do violent video games cause acts of violence? And the things I've always, and this might sound sort of flippant, but... You know, I've been playing video games for as long as I can remember, and now I'm running a charity organization. So it's kind of like, what does that tell you, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think the real point is that a wide variety of people play video games. I mean, especially nowadays, everyone plays... You have Angry Birds on your phone. We were talking about this earlier.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You have Angry Birds on your phone, so the person who plays Mass Effect. So you may not identify yourself as a gamer, but... If you play a video game, you're technically sort of a gamer.
And I got to tell you, it's kind of funny because I know that I had to load certain games onto my iPhone when I was driving my granddaughter back and forth because she'd say, Grandpa, can I have the phone? And I said, why? Oh, I want to play games. And gee, I didn't have any. So I had to get Fruit Ninja. Mm-hmm. I had to get Temple Run. I had to get – there's a whole bunch of them that are kind of mandatory to put on – they're free games, many of them, to put onto my iPhone so the kids can play with them because this becomes the time passing for these
kids. And it just shows you how big the industry is. I mean, you talk about gamers and you don't – like Zach said, you don't want to lump them into one little group because my wife right now is probably listening to the show playing Bejeweled on her iPad.
Yes.
She's a gamer. She's gaming on a digital device.
Yes.
You know,
that is an addictive game.
But
chances are pretty high she's not drinking Mountain Dew, Red Bull, and sitting in the basement.
She's probably drinking wine.
Okay, there you go.
Yes. She's that type of gamer, a wino gamer.
Those
are the best kind, though. They really are.
You certainly have enjoyed it.
Nothing like a little Chablis with your angry bird.
Right. Yeah, what do you drink with Call of Duty?
A little Halo and vodka. There we go.
Oh, Lord have mercy. Oh, Zach Weigel, tell us about, again, your Gamer Forgiving before we go off the rails entirely. It's coming up again. This is going to be Saturday and Sunday?
Yeah,
16th
Saturday
and 17th. It's going to be at Eastern Michigan University. If people show up at the door, how much does it cost to get in and watch?
It's to just come and watch. It's free to spectate. $25 if you want to participate per person.
Okay, and how would they participate again? Because the LAN is sold out, right?
Yeah, so one of our activities within the event is sold out now. But the Halo tournament, Call of Duty tournament, those are actually 4v4 tournaments. So you need a team of yourself and three other individuals, four total. And you can register through our website. If you go to gamersoutreach.org, there's a little link at the top that says Gamers Forgiving. You can click that and There's a whole bunch of pages with information. And if you show up,
again, if you click on our homepage, internetadvisor.net, click on Zach's name or Gamers for Giving 2013.
If you've never seen this kind of gameplay before, this competitive game, you'd be amazed. It's almost like a sporting event. You know, you've got commentators, and then you've got the field.
That's astounding.
And the communication that goes on with these teams is incredible. So
now, you're going to be streaming it as well at twitch.tv?
Yep, /LANFest.
/LANFest. I'm going to see it. I'll post that for you folks later on, for those of you who can catch that. Twitch.tv. Twitch, I love that. /LANFest. Zach Weigel, it's always a ball having you in here. Let's know how this goes, okay?
Yeah, for sure.
We'll be back in just a second with Rich Yaroslavsky talking from Bloomberg News about all the news on computers. Just a reminder for you, by the way, if you go to internetadvisor.net, you will find all of the links to the various content that we talk about on our program here. My name is Foster Brown, the co-host of the program, and Ed Riddell, Kel Carson, and Shane Hamlin are in studio with me. And one of the favorite people we like to bring around when it comes to talking about some of the items that are in the news is Rich Yaroslavsky from Bloomberg News. And boy, have we got a lot to talk about. Rich, welcome to the Internet Advisor.
Great to be back.
Yeah, boy, there's been a lot to talk about this week. Everything from Dell going private to the Microsoft Surface Pro coming out. Where shall we start?
Well, I would start with the Surface Pro, which is an interesting machine, and it's caused a little bit of controversy since it was released this week.
In terms of the controversy, first of all, let's explain to people a little bit about what the Microsoft Surface Pro is, and then maybe go towards the controversy.
Well, this is the first honest-to-God, full-fledged Windows PC that Microsoft has ever made. They released a version of it earlier, about 4 or 5 months ago, that couldn't run all the Windows programs. But this one is a full-fledged PC.
And that first one was called the Surface RT, right?
Exactly.
Right.
And this one is more expensive. It is a sort of a mutant hybrid. It looks like a tablet, but when you snap on one of Microsoft's snazzy keyboard cover combinations, it turns into a full-fledged Windows laptop.
So let's talk the pros and cons of this. By the way, February the 9th, it officially launched. It was supposed to be in, I'm sorry, I'm chuckling, it's terrible, it's because it was such bad luck for Microsoft, downtown New York, in the middle of the storm of the century.
Oh,
yeah. I don't know if that's kind of like, you know, prophetic about what's going to happen to the machine and the company, perhaps. But let's talk about the pros and cons of this machine.
Well, the pros are that as a PC, it is, it's very light, 2.5 pounds with the keyboard cover, about 2 pounds without it. It's a full-fledged Windows 8 machine, so it runs, all the legacy programs, the hundreds of thousands or millions of programs written for previous versions of Windows. So it's got an instant library of programs that it'll run. Very portable and an innovative design, nice screen. It's got a lot going for it, but there are a number of very large caveats.
Okay, and they would be, as I understand it, some of it is about storage, am I right?
Some of it is about storage. If you get the 64-gigabyte model, which starts at $899 without the keyboard, by the time Windows 8 takes its overhead, you don't have that much room left for your own programs and your own data. So it almost makes the 128-gigabyte one, which is $1,000, the minimally useful configuration.
Now, I've seen those the Surface Pro compared head-to-head to the MacBook Air, and the conversation was that they were pretty similar in terms of storage, capacity, operating systems, et cetera, except that the Windows 8 machine has a touch screen on it and the MacBook Air doesn't. Do you think that's a fair comparison?
I think it's a fair comparison, though it's not really the comparison that Microsoft has been pushing.
Hmm.
What Microsoft wants you to think of this device is not only a Windows PC, but as an iPad substitute.
Hmm.
And it just isn't.
Yeah.
It's heavier, much heavier than an iPad. It is not nearly as responsive. It does have a very nice screen on it, but what Microsoft would like would be for this to be the one device that replaces both a laptop
right.
and a tablet.
Right.
And the biggest weakness, I think, is the battery life, which
yeah.
is very, very much less than you would get from either an iPad or an Android tablet.
Well, in looking at this machine, in my opinion, what I've read up and stuff like that, do you? I would think that Microsoft is creating more of a different niche than competing directly with a tablet or a laptop, for that matter. Would you agree with that?
Well, I think I don't know that that's necessarily what they set out to do, but I think that's the net effect.
Yeah. Right.
And the problem is that this niche that they've created is problematic because it's compromised on both scores. It's not as powerful as and as flexible to a certain extent as a full-fledged laptop would be, and yet it's not as lightweight or responsive as a tablet would be. So it's kind of compromised on both sides.
Yeah, you know, one thing I've heard from more than one person and several executives, including our Gary Baker, who had tried to use the iPad as a substitute. I'm going cross-country. I'm leaving my laptop behind me. I'm going to see if I can use this device to do my daily activities. And they came to the conclusion they could not. You know, you can't manipulate PowerPoint presentations. You may be able to view them. You wanted to do some editing, not possible. This one, like you said, might be that niche where you could go cross country for a couple days and possibly survive without a full fledged.
If you're
laptop.
Close to an outlet,
I did. I in fact did that last week.
Excellent!
I went to New York, and I normally travel with a MacBook Air. I left that behind. I could not bring myself to leave the iPad behind. So the iPad came too.
Okay.
And this the Surface worked pretty well as I was running, you know, full-fledged Microsoft Office 2013 and running full-fledged Windows programs on it, and it worked pretty well. I was barely able to coax it on a cross-country flight from New York to San Francisco, which was about 6 hours of battery life. That's really the absolute max I think you're going to get on it. I've seen reports of people getting as little as 4.5 hours on a charge. Obviously, it depends on what you're using it for.
Well, I was going to say, were you using it to watch movies and things like that?
I was watching some videos. I was working. I was doing some writing on the flight. I try and do sort of mixed activities.
Right. Just kind of a quick one. Then Microsoft has come out with the Windows Phone 8. They come out with their Surface machines. And the response in the market has been kind of, yeah, they're really beautiful, well-built, but there just doesn't seem to be a tremendous amount of enthusiasm about these products. Could this be a very serious downturn, the beginning of a downturn for Microsoft?
Well, I think that if you're Microsoft, you have to be concerned. You have to kind of look around, and you're kind of under siege on all sides. We also saw this week the release of new Chromebooks from
yes.
companies that are normally, you know, associated very closely with Microsoft and Windows. You look at the new BlackBerry, which on some level is certainly, if it catches on, is certainly a threat to to Microsoft's hopes to at least claw to, you know, position number three in the smartphone market. You look at the new Microsoft Office, which is
yes.
a very nice suite of programs, but Microsoft is trying to sell it as a subscription now.
Yeah.
And boy, is it complicated for an average consumer to sort of figure out what the best.
Yeah, the math is tough to do.
So I guess it would be probably, maybe I'm being a little flippant, and I don't mean to be that sort of way, but would it be safe to say that even though the ideas sound good, Microsoft needs to stay in the software business and not play in a hardware field because they can't seem to get a real focus on hardware. Other than the Xbox, they're having a hard time getting focus on it, even the phone, even the Surface tablet.
Well, they they don't currently make their own phones, though there is there are all sorts of rumors that they're working on something.
Oh.
The last effort that they came out with that was a Microsoft-branded phone was something called the Kin, which came out a couple
yes.
years ago and disappeared almost overnight.
Yeah, akin to disaster. Hey, Rich, before we just quick, I want to ask you about Chromebooks after we take a pause here, because I think that's something that's fascinating a lot of people. But before we get there, it has just been announced that Detroit area is going to be getting its very own Microsoft Superstore. It'll be out at the Somerset Place where Apple is right now, very high-end shopping area north of Detroit in the suburb called Troy. I understand that you have seen one of these Microsoft shops in play out by you.
I live near the Stanford Shopping Center, which is a high-end shopping center. It's actually on land owned by Stanford University.
Mm-hmm.
And there is an Apple store two doors down from the Microsoft store in the mall.
Mm.
And it's kind of always been kind of interesting. I do little informal channel checks. The Microsoft store is about three times the size of the Apple store, but it does seem most of the time to have about one-third the foot traffic.
What is there to see in a Microsoft store other than the Surface? You know, I mean, that's uniquely Microsoft, other than maybe a phone or a laptop.
Well, they've got the Surface. They've got Windows phones from their, you know, their principal partners, Nokia and HTC, I think, are on display there. They also have, you know, some innovative Windows 8 laptops from other hardware manufacturers.
Mm. Okay, so they're there, and they've got the mice and some other things to look at as well. Rich Yaroslavsky is with us from Bloomberg News. Rich, when you come back, I want you to tell us about Chromebooks and whether you think this really could be the next thing in computing. You know, before we go too much further here, I want to say a belated happy birthday to Mike Wendland, an old friend of ours and a tech commentator as well. PC Mike is his name. And thank you, Mike, for being part of our lives for many, many years. Great commentator both online and on TV and radio as well. Right now, we're delighted to have with us one of our favorite commentators, and that's Rich Yaroslavsky from Bloomberg News. And we're talking about some of the trends that have been going on in the news this week. A lot of stuff happening. Among them, Rich, let's talk a little bit about Chromebooks. HP announcing that it was releasing, I think it was a 10-inch Chromebook. Talk, if you could, tell our audience a little bit about what a Chromebook is, and then if you've had your hands on one, I'd love to hear what your feeling was about it.
Well, the Chromebook is a laptop that does not run traditional software or traditional operating system. Essentially, the Google Chrome web browser is its operating system. So everything it does, all the programs it runs, everything it does is all in the cloud. So you need an internet connection, and basically, once you have an internet connection, you're good to go.
Can you use it without an internet connection?
Well, that's one of the weaknesses. Google has been working on offline modes. There are more things that you can do offline, but I've never been a huge fan of them, primarily because when you're in a place on an airplane or something where there isn't Wi-Fi access,
mm-hmm.
What you can do becomes really, really constrained.
Right, exactly.
It's like carrying around a dumb terminal in some ways. But
yeah.
That's exactly what it is. But on the other hand, I also, although I've never really been a huge enthusiast for Chromebooks, they are an existential threat to Microsoft.
How so?
When you look at where Microsoft's money comes from, a disproportionate amount still comes from Windows and Microsoft Office. If you have a laptop that doesn't have Windows and doesn't have Microsoft Office, that's a direct threat to the core franchises. And if those franchises go away before Microsoft can establish other things like the Surface or phones or whatever, then it's kind of game over.
Hmm, very interesting.
Hey, Rich, question if I like. Lately in the news, it's been talking about Dell going private again. What does this mean, and why would they do that?
Well, I think this is going to be a fascinating one to watch. Clearly, the PC manufacturing business is under a great deal of pressure. Not only do you have the rise of things like Chromebooks and that sort of thing, but the fact that Microsoft itself is going into the hardware business, I think, has given a lot of its traditional hardware partners pause. And so, you see HP sort of hedging its bets with the Chromebook. Mm. What Dell is trying to do is to really restructure the business. Dell has made a lot of acquisitions so that it's gone considerably beyond the traditional PC business. But they really need to restructure their entire business, And I think they think it's going to be easier to do that if they're private than if they're doing it under the glare of being a public company and having, you know, legions of unhappy shareholders.
Then I hear that they're what they're going to try to do, because they haven't done much in terms of the mobile line. As I said, they had the Axim, and was their cell phone for a while, and it just really didn't do them too much.
And they had the Dell Streak tablet, yeah, which also flamed out.
Yeah, that flamed out as well. So they really haven't done much in that area. I've heard it said that one of the things they're trying to get into now is services and kind of play off of their enterprise, because they've got a lot of their equipment in businesses.
I think that that's a big part of what they're trying to do, and some of the acquisitions that they've made are certainly focused in that direction. You know, this is something, though, that it's a crowded field. You have IBM, which sort of pioneered the course of moving from a hardware-based company to a services-based company. You have HP, which bought EDF and which has had a rockier path. And so it's at this point, the question is, you know, can Dell bring something new enough to the party to establish the services business as the core business in the future? And, oh, by the way, since you need computers, we'll be glad to sell you out.
Yeah, exactly. Just curiosity, what computer, if you were at the place right now of buying a new computer, what would you buy?
Well, as an individual consumer, I'd probably, if I was looking at a desktop, I'd look at an iMac and something like Parallels Desktop, which allows you to run Windows in the Mac environment, which I actually do on my MacBook Air.
Why do you run Windows at all? I mean, there'll be parallel programs, for instance, some of the Office programs they have on the Mac.
Because Bloomberg, like many other companies, has is a Windows-based company, and has developed, you know, proprietary software or macros built around Windows-based programs. So it's a huge convenience to be able to run Windows.
Yeah, and that seems to me, by the way, Rich, to be the one foot that Microsoft still has in the door.
And make no mistake, it's a huge one.
Oh yeah.
I mean, Microsoft is a is an enormous company. It is a very profitable company. It ain't going away soon, if at all. And you know, I know it feels like we've been bashing Microsoft a little bit here, but you know, it is still an enormous company with enormous assets. The thing is that the things that Microsoft is strongest in are not the areas of the industry that are growing the fastest. And, you know, it's to a certain extent, you've got to be kind of like a shark. You've got to constantly keep moving and feeding and growing.
Yep. Yeah, it's interesting because the reverse could be said of Apple. Apple is in the place where the industry is growing the fastest, which are the mobile devices, the tablets and the phones. And so it is moving. It's a very fast-moving shark. One last thing. I know you were there for the BlackBerry event when they launched their new phone and operating system. Impressed?
I was impressed. You know, I think it was Benjamin Franklin who said, "There's nothing that so concentrates the mind so wonderfully as the prospect of a hanging." Well, I think that you know, BlackBerry was looking at the possibility of being hung if this didn't work.
Yeah.
So they've done something that's really good. What I can't answer, what only the marketplace is going to be able to answer, is whether or not the fact that they've done something good is going to be enough, because they've had years of mediocre products, years of corporate floundering, and you know, the nightmare scenario is they've finally done something that's really good, but it's too little too late.
I'm just curious, do you think that they will end up being the number three smartphone maker? You've got Samsung on top with Android devices, having the major ones, and you've got Apple, the close second in terms of the ones that are out there. Who's going to have third place, BlackBerry or Microsoft?
Well, that's an interesting question, and you know, they're going to be fighting with each other for some time for third place in the operating system sweepstakes. But the thing you have to kind of remind yourself is, whichever one wins, it's still only third place.
Yes.
And all the profits in this industry, as far as I can tell, are accruing to, you know, Apple and Samsung. Right. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't leave a whole lot left over for third place.
Not much to pick on. Rich Ostrowski, thank you so much, folks. You can find Rich's columns in the Bloomberg News. Look for it online. Rich, again, delighted to have you with us here.
Always a pleasure.
All right, take care. Well, folks, we have another hour of our program coming up, and in that hour, which will be approaching very soon, we're going to be taking your phone calls at 800-859-0957. That's 800-859-0957. Shane, I want to ask you, since you work in a shop where you sell computers to people, what's flying out the door right now?
Right now, tablets. People love tablets. They're coming in, trying them out, test driving them.
Mobile devices.
Yeah, mobile devices.
And would you say they're looking for the Google-based ones, like the Nexus?
No, you know, the Android, you know, that's the big name right now with the tablets. Mostly Android. Desktops, not so much, though.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's either going to be a laptop or a tablet now, it seems.
Anybody buying Windows 8 phone computers?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. A lot of people want to know what it's all about.
Fair
and coming in and playing with it and stuff.
Well, we've got some answers for you, by the way, if you have some questions about Windows 8, because some of us have been using that for a while now. I've been about 3 months that I've been using it. Shane, I think, has been using it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You other guys have at various times, Ed and Cal. But we've got experts. We've got a room full of experts here. And here's the number again, 800-859-0957. Get on the line and get in line. And we will get to your questions when we come back after the news.
Whether you're listening to us on one of our affiliates through Michigan Talk Radio or through our podcast, contact us by email if you have a question through our homepage at InternetAdvisor.net or put your question into one of our forums. Now let's rejoin the Internet Advisor.
Well, as they say, we're loaded for bear, and this is the third hour of the Internet Advisor. Hi, Foster Brown, and in studio with me, I've got a ton of technical help, all the experts you could want. Mr. Ed Riddell, Mr. Cal Carson, and Shane Hamlin are here with us, representing people who have been very experienced in dealing with PCs and with Macs. So whatever your question is, even Windows 8, we'll take a crack at answering it. 800-859-0957. Call us now. Thank you once again for joining us here for the Internet Advisor. And by the way, if you're listening to our podcast, this is going to be the segment of the program where we're going to be taking listeners' calls and answering them for you. And some of you have already sent us questions through the Contact Us form on the homepage. And our forums are open as well, where 24 hours, 7 days a week, on our homepage, you can get some help from a lot of great people who are out there. But right now, we're going to be going to our phone lines, and let me give you the number again, 800-859-0957. Ed Riddell, Cal Carson, Shane Hamlin in studio. Thanks, guys, for being here. A lot of experience represented here, so if you've got a problem, please don't sit on it. This is the time to get an answer for it. And as we often say, the only dumb questions are the ones you don't ask. And as a matter of fact, when you ask a question, you're most likely going to help somebody else who is struggling with that same kind of thing. We'd love to hear from you. The phone number again, 800-859-0957. And let's just dive right in, guys, and welcome Bob from Plymouth. Hi, Bob. How you doing?
Well, I'm doing all right, and I'm up to date on all the information on the Weather Channel.
Oh, I bet you are. Oh, my Lord. Listen, we've got this wonderful sunny weather on this February
yes,
the 9th.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, we can just smile with that right now. Who knows what it's going to be later on.
Yes, we can.
So, what can we do for you?
I wish I could smile with my new computer, though.
Uh-oh. What's up?
Well, I've had Windows XP, which I liked.
Yep.
Never had a problem with. Windows 7, never had a problem with. Bought a new laptop.
Mm-hmm.
Terabyte worth of, you know, RAM and all of this good stuff. And Windows 8.
Windows 8.
And I want to tell you, if there was some way that I thought I could take that out of there easily, I don't have a smartphone. I don't want a smartphone.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want a smart computer that has all the same apps as a smartphone.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see any way of getting rid of them.
Yeah, you want like a traditional user, pardon me, a computer interface, not any of this fancy schmancy tile stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't mind having a little, you know, stock market app and a weather app.
Yeah,
that's fine.
Yeah.
You know, but I had that stuff before. This is now getting ridiculous.
Well,
I got this Windows Xbox 360 that pops up. There's no way in the world I can get rid of it because I can't even find it because Windows Explorer doesn't exist anymore, apparently.
Well, there are ways, there's a couple of things we can get into about how to find things on there. I guess we ought to deal with maybe, what do you think, guys, is the first angle we ought to deal with on? Whether that you can roll back to 7
well,
or
let
what?
Me, well, what version of Windows 8 do you have, Bob?
I don't. You know what? I don't know.
It was the one that came with your new computer.
Because it,
yes, sir, yes.
If you have Pro,
and it has been updated, but you know,
yeah. I mean, if you have Windows 8 Pro, you can downgrade to Windows 7 Pro.
Oh, you can.
And you can use the same key and everything. Yep. You just download it from Microsoft.
Just download it from Microsoft.
Did you hear that?
So,
Noah?
How do you find out what version?
Oh. of Windows. Right?
Yes, but only with Windows 8 Pro. Just right-click on, you know, my computer.
With if Windows 8 Pro.
Yeah, if you have Windows 8 Pro, you can downgrade to Windows 7 Pro just by downloading, you know, going to Microsoft, downloading Windows 7, and using the same key to reactivate.
Now, if I don't, I'm out of luck, eh?
Unfortunately, yes.
Well, if you then you would have to upgrade to Windows Pro, which
might work.
Can you still buy a license of Windows 7 Professional?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the point is, if you've got Windows 8 Pro, you already have it. You don't pay anything extra.
Right. Yeah. Right.
You can just download Windows 7. And as and he was saying, and you know what he means when he says the key?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the product key that you have. And you can even find that on the My Computer, right-clicking and find a My Computer. Now, a couple of things. So if you don't have it, you can upgrade to Windows 8 Pro, and then you can go to Microsoft and download Windows 7 Pro and go back to that. The other thing, too, Bob, is that you can work pretty much on the desktop with everything that you want to do in Windows 8. And if you want to get rid of something, for instance, let's say the Xbox tile is bothering you. Okay?
Yes.
Right-click on it, then look down at the bottom, and it says unpin, and you can unpin it, and it won't show up again. It won't bother you again.
Okay.
Okay? You can uninstall from there. If there's something there, a program you don't want, you can uninstall as well. But if you simply unpin it, it means that when you're on that page where you have those colorful tiles, you won't see it. It won't be there. It won't bother you. It won't talk to you at all.
See, I'm learning something from Foster because I don't have a Windows 8 laptop yet. So I've played with it.
You guys have just got some of the guys in the studio here just got the key
newbies.
For their Windows 8. They're complete newbies, and I've had like 2-3 months with it, and so I'm still new because Jenny is the one who's on it most of the time.
Bob, do you mind if I ask you what don't you like about? I mean, besides the tiles, I mean, because you can work right from the desktop, and with a little bit of tweaking here, you can get your start
or the legacy dash. You know what used to look like.
Yeah, that's probably so. I used Windows Explorer a lot in both XP and 7 because I have a lot of different things, and it was easy to find.
Well, now, let me give you a little something about how to find it. Excuse me, with the apps, go to your home page where you've got the tiles, okay?
Yes.
Right-click down on the right-hand side, and there should be a button now that says All Apps. Okay, that's one thing. And it will show you all of the applications on your computer. Or, and this is the simplest thing, when you're on the home page with the start with the tiles, start typing.
Yes.
For instance, I use an audio editor called Goldwave. I would simply go to that tile page and start typing Goldwave. Up pops the charm bar on the right, and in it will show you programs and settings and files that relate to that, and you can go boom right into your. It'll take you right into, for instance, Goldwave. That would open up on the desktop right away, and it would look like it always had. So I hope we've given you some help with that, Bob. We got to take a break right now, but for the rest of you out there with Windows 8, don't give up quite yet. We'd like to be able to give you a hand with it, and give us a call 800-859-0957. Now we are in our 16th year of doing the Internet Advisor, and this is how we begin answering people's questions. In 1998, I was doing the Great Weekend program on WJR, which is our flagship station in Detroit, and Gary Baker ran my ISP, and I was having some problems connecting, called him up while I was on the show to get some answers, and a whole bunch of other people heard that. They had questions, too, and as we talked about at the beginning of the first hour of the program, 1998 was when the big changes were going on from Windows 95 and others.
I was in diapers. I don't know. No, I'm just kidding.
Shame on you with the geek speak. You just said the word ISP and didn't even explain what it meant.
Right. My internet service provider. Thank you, Ken.
When they were still mom and pop ISP.
Yes, they were. And Gary was one of the pops.
Yeah, he was.
It was Online Technologies. But that's how we began. So we love this part of the program, which is getting your calls at 800-859-0957 and asking us questions about your computers, about getting one, about getting over some problems. Maybe you run into some malware. We'd love to help tackle that problem with you. We get most of our emails about that. So here's
you know what happened, Foster? You know, speaking about 15 years that we've been doing the radio show and how much has changed on the internet how ads are on there and how animated they are now. One of the websites I just enjoy going to is Craigslist because it hasn't changed since the day it's come out, really. But, you know, Until just a couple of weeks ago, I noticed that while I'm in Craigslist, and I always did the photo view or image view.
I didn't even know there was another view there besides that one list.
It just sort of sneaks up there where you have the ability to list all these items in Craigslist, musical instruments or whatever. And I like going into the free section because I find stuff in there that I'll pick up on the way home from work for Boy Scouts, like leather. You know, kids are always, you know, give them leather and they'll make something out of it. And...
Who knows what it is, but something.
So I went out there a couple days ago and a couple weeks ago, and they have a grid view now. So not only can I view it with a small image to the left, I can also select grid view, which fills up the screen sort of like Google Images.
Like Pinterest in some ways. It almost looks like Pinterest in the sense you have a full picture, big picture in there so you can see what you're looking at.
And I can just
plus the contact information.
And plus I can quickly scroll through the information. Now they also have a map view. So
so cool.
So I can just click on it and say, who's selling things in Lake Orion or Oxford, which is close to Ortonville? And then I go, and I could just hover over it, and it'll say it's a 150-year-old chest.
What it gives you, folks, is it gives you a map of whatever area you happen to be in with little icons all over the map, representing free stuff or whatever the thing is you're
musical
looking for.
Instruments, right.
And you just hover over that and bang, it shows you what it is.
And it's so amazing just to watch Ed over here. He's just totally glazed.
Well, that's what we do in between the hours is Cal and I will quickly go to free to see, you know, hey, Cal, can you pick up that couch for me that was sitting on that person's porch? Because he happens to be driving by that area.
This, folks, is what the Internet Advisors has devolved to in 15 years.
And we call it networking.
There you go. There you go. And that's the way it was long before. Before we had Twitter. Okay, Sam from Lansing, welcome to the Internet Advisor. What may we do to help you? Hello, Sam.
Hello.
Hi, how are you doing? How can we help you?
I have a few questions about buying a laptop.
Sure.
I'm looking. They're both HPs. The size is one's a 14, one's 15.6 inch. I was wondering, the difference is, with Windows 8, is 4 gigabytes enough? I know you always say more memory, versus 6, because Windows 8 takes 2 gigabytes.
Okay. And what was the other question you had, just to get them in line here?
The other was...
what was the other device? You had Windows 8 was one device. What was the other device?
No, they're both Windows 8. They're both HP. It's just they differ, like, in the memory.
Yes.
One is 4, one is 6. And their processor, one is an i5, the other is an A8.
Okay, now there you have an interesting difference, guys. One is going to be an Intel processor, an i5, and the other one is an A8, which is an AMD, I'm going to guess.
I would assume. I'm not familiar with that.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right, Shane?
Yeah.
Yeah, because you do this all the time. Mm-hmm. So why don't you help this gentleman out?
You know, it's always good to have extra RAM. Right? I mean, that's kind of the thing. Extra memory is nice, but you got to look at the price. You know,
exactly.
Are you going to be paying an extra $150 or $200 for this extra RAM, which would cost you, you know, DDR3 is cheap as heck right now. Yeah. That's something I would always look at because you can always upgrade more memory down the road if you need to.
Right.
You know, if you're going to have such a huge thing going with the i5 with 4 gigs of RAM, DDR3 should be plenty fast for a Windows 8 machine.
Right.
I mean, it really should.
What are you planning on doing with the computer, Sam?
Stuff, internet, email, and browsing, and maybe a little bit games.
What's the price difference, Sam?
It's about $100. One is about $440. The other is $540.
The one that's $440 has got the 4 gigs in it?
Yeah, 4 gigs. i5.
Yeah.
That's got the i5,
too. Yeah, the i5's a great processor.
And it doesn't have a DVD drive.
Yeah, well, a lot of systems are not coming with it.
That's where you're going to save some money, but also realize that an external DVD drive will work just fine.
Just as fine.
Is a bigger screen important for you?
Little bit, but not so much. They're just an inch difference.
Yeah, and that's not even viewable. I mean, you're not going to, you know, the 14 versus the 15.6 or whatever it is.
One's probably widescreen, the other one's probably standard screen. But, you know, if those things aren't really important to you and you're basically going to do the functions you had just talked about, you could go with the lower cost alternative and be just as happy.
The other thing I was wondering, though, with AMD, do you have to worry about it overheating?
Actually, it's probably just the opposite. I think AMDs run a little bit cooler than the Intel processor.
Oh,
yep.
You know.
Really? Because they used to say AMD always ran hotter.
No. I think you may. I'm not going to dispute your information, but in general, you know, in the industry, always like when we're gamers, we always preferred the AMD processor because it did run cooler.
Oh, okay.
Now here's the bottom line: if you're going to feel more comfortable with an Intel processor, buy the Intel. If you're going to feel comfortable with Shane's advice on AMD, buy the AMD.
Right.
Because I've used both, actually.
Mm-hmm. I have too.
So that's why it's just...
Yeah, I think it only makes a big difference, and don't let the salesman fool you on this, it only makes a real big difference if you're going to do much more complex things.
Yeah.
And then it may be a matter of a bigger video card or a graphics video card with a lot more memory on board and not the processor necessarily. But for what you described using it, and folks, there's a rule of thumb. What are you going to use it for? And if it isn't rocket science, you're not going to be designing the next bridge over the Detroit River, then you probably can go with some of this basic stuff. Either one of those would be a fine system.
Sam, I would totally, for what you're doing, $100 cheaper, yep. I wouldn't even sweat it. Don't even worry about it. The AMD or the Intel i5 4 gigs is going to be just fine.
And you can always boost the RAM later on if you want to. Okay, Sam, thanks so much for giving us a call. Let's jump over to Jack, who's calling us from Dexter. Hi, Jack. How you doing?
Yeah, hi. Not bad. Just to let you know I enjoy your program very much.
Thank you. What's your question?
My question is this. I've got a Verizon hotspot in the house out in the country that works pretty good. It works fine on a variety of computers. I have four or five of them that go through it. However, I have two Sonys that will log on to the hotspot, and I see the address and the name, and the and it declares that there's a connection and a signal level, yet I cannot connect to the Internet through it. It just stops right there.
Okay, I didn't know. I'm sorry. Let me just go ahead and finish your comment.
Yeah, I changed out the little card in the Sony TR1 and reloaded the software, and I get the same results.
Hmm. That's interesting. I'm sorry. What was the first device that you said connects to it without a problem?
My other computers.
Really? Are these newer? Are the Sony's newer computers?
No, these have been around a while. One of them's a UX, and the other's a TR1.
Well, hold on the line, and then we'll get back to you after this. I think I might have a couple suggestions, and
And we'll get back to you, Jack, to talk about that. And let's get some more information, as a matter of fact, maybe from you off the air about what exactly the models you were working for. It may sound like older models are having trouble making the connection. Welcome to the Internet Advisor. Thanks again to Jason Iameta and Rich Lucinski and Andy Nichols, who are behind the glass helping us out with our program. And now let's go back. Oh, number again, 800-859-0957. Plenty of time for your call, by the way. Let's go back out. Jack, hi. Jack is in Dexter, which is just west of Ann Arbor. Some sketchy signals out there. But, Jack, you have used the Verizon hotspot. You bought one of those, right?
Right. I've been using it for almost a year.
Yeah.
And it works. It works with everything else I have.
Let me just say to the, there are a lot of people who listen to us in a lot of rural areas. If you can get that kind of thing, that's a great way of connecting to the Internet because they connect, at least the ones that we've had here in the studio, connect really well. Now, your problem is you have a bunch of computers. It sounds like about four, right?
Or better than that. I probably have eight of them.
But there are two of them, and they are older Sonys that are simply not connecting through that Wi-Fi hotspot to the Internet. The other ones do with no problems. Now, guys, I think you had some thoughts. Eddie?
Well, it's like seven or eight different things. But do these Sonys, if they had access to the Internet, would they work if you took them somewhere else? Have you tried that? McDonald's or...
Yeah, Starbucks. I've tried that, and they look like they're connecting, but they just don't. I get it shows the signal strength, it shows the name of the Wi-Fi connection.
Gotcha.
Okay, good. That helps to isolate some problems.
Okay, so if this was mine, the first thing I would do, what version of Windows is it?
XP? I think they're XP.
Yeah, I would go into the device manager on that computer, and on XP, you right mouse click on my computer. You select the hardware tab, go into the device manager by pressing the button. I would, underneath the network, you see a list of all the components, that hardware components that make up the computer. Find the network devices and then I would find your wireless network adapters. They'll be listed in there, and it's pretty obvious because they'll say something like Wi-Fi or wireless network adapter or 802.11 something or another.
Right.
Highlight it, or single click on it, then strike the delete key, and then reboot the computer. When you strike the delete key, it's going to delete it from the profile. It's going to ask you, do you wish to delete this device? Yes. Do you wish to delete the drivers for this device? No. And it restart your computer. Windows will reload the software. And Shane, you brought up a good point off air on these. And that is, normally Windows, Microsoft, has its own native wireless discovery tool.
Yeah, that will handle the wireless portion of your device. And a lot of times, what brought that up was I was thinking two Sonys. Probably right. Sony has some kind of a wireless software installed.
Right. You have a choice.
Yeah.
Use the XP or the...
Have you tried taking that choice and going to the Microsoft?
Yes, I have. Okay. I have the other one's a UX.
Yeah.
Sony UX
and then,
280.
Well, let me ask you this. If you hardwire it and plug it in hardwire, does it work?
I think I have. I hate to say that, be so... guessing on it, but yeah. I think I did it once on the TR1, but I agree, but to try it with the...
Yeah.
How about not only taking the driver off of the... How about the network adapter driver itself besides the wire?
Oh, sure. It wouldn't hurt, really. It doesn't hurt doing that. And the other thing you could...
Both of them, eh?
Yeah. You could do both, and Windows will discover them. Now, if this fails, Windows... Microsoft had a... what was it, the TCP/IP or Winsock loader for Windows XP?
Oh, yeah.
There used to be utility for that that would force...
The renewal.
The renewal of reloading all the native Windows networking software, mm-hmm. the TCP/IP software. Okay. On occasion, when I ran across a cruder, I think it's called... It's a Winsock Fix, I think is what it's called.
Correct.
And Winsock Fix.
Yeah.
Winsock Fix. Yeah. And it's a utility. It's every once in a while we run across one of these computers. It would fail. I would download that from another computer, run it on these computers, and that usually fixes these really weird problems.
Okay.
So give that a try,
Winsock
Jack.
Winsock Fix. Okay, I'll try that.
All right, Jack. Thank you. Let us know how these things go, and we will try to keep on listening and seeing if we can fix these things for you. Jerry from Hudson, Michigan. Welcome to the Internet Advisor.
Yeah, thank you.
Sure.
I have a similar problem. I have the Verizon MiFi card, and my contract is about up, and I've had problems with that. I was wondering, where else could I get a card with another, say, AT&T and so forth? Do some of the others... providers have that?
Well, I think one of the first things I'm going to guess you should ask is take a check down in Hudson, Michigan. You happen to be in one of those dead spots in the state of Michigan. I'm sorry to say that, but the very south, yeah. And the problem is, I don't know if there are any other providers in your area. Wait, guys, what was the website you go to check for internet providers?
I was just looking for this.
Hang on a second. One of the guys is going to look this up. But there's a website you can go to. I think you put your zip code in, and it tells you who will provide.
But the other thing is that Verizon offers pay-as-you-go by monthly service now. If you're on a two-year service agreement, that you could call them up and ask them if you could pay as you go. It's probably a little more expensive.
Until
you find another provider or something. And then you could talk to them about your intermittent service that you're having right now and at the same time. So I'd like to continue with you, but I'm really getting poor service.
Yeah. And, you know, we were looking for that. I think there's one here that's called... wirelessadvisor.com. So,
well, there's that one, but there's also broadband. I'm looking for this.
I'll give you. You know, if you don't want to switch, who do you have right now? Verizon, you said?
Verizon.
I mean, they all have, you know, T-Mobile. Do you have a smartphone?
No, I don't.
Yeah, but see, with my T-Mobile smartphone, I can just turn on my MiFi and connect my laptop that way.
Yeah, but I think the problem is the signal quality in that area is not that good. Is that part of the problem, Jerry?
That's part of it, yes.
Yeah, that's part of the problem as well. So,
well, sometimes you he
needs to find a cellular provider in the area, and there's only so many carriers: AT&T, Verizon, and Sprint. And other than that, then T-Mobile uses basically the same channels as AT&T or same signals.
See, there may be one of the other things you may have, and like I just went to wireless broadband internet Hudson, Michigan, all right? There are a number of them in that area. Like this one happens to be Broadband Blue. And what some of these do is that in Hudson, Michigan, we had our friend Charlie Hopper from the Upper Peninsula on yesterday, last week during our anniversary program. And one of the things he was talking about is that he provides people, he's a local provider, with a Wi-Fi connection. In other words, he WiMaxes the signal, microwaves it essentially, to a tower, then it drops down into a community. You may have somebody like this Broadband Blue, try that three times, in Hudson, that is providing that kind of thing. Or they have a microwave dish that they can put up. That it'll be more expensive, but you might be able to get a better connection. But so I'd suggest just research what other broadband alternatives there are in your area, okay?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. All right, and see if that helps you. Because I don't know that he's going to get much better from the cell companies, because I don't think any of them have a real good signal down there. Mm-hmm. And what you get is these little companies like this Broadband Blue that will pick up a good connection, you know,
right.
And then they will just repeat it out to certain areas with with Wi-Fi, for instance. All right, let's see if we can help Mary in Unstead. Hi, Mary. How you doing?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
How can we help you?
Well, I have Comcast as my provider.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
And
don't
yeah.
Do that.
Well, we're limited out here.
I'm going to get hung back.
I love Comcast.
On my email through it. Infinity, they mm-hmm. keep giving me messages that my computer has been detected that it has a bot.
Oh, stop. Stop right there.
Okay. Okay. What is notifying you of this? I'm sorry.
Through my email.
Oh, okay.
Comcast does the Xfinity email.
Mm-hmm.
And so, last week, my computer had another issue, and the computer shop that repaired it had to do back to the factory settings.
Okay.
So they took everything off and restored it back to the factory settings.
Okay.
Should that not have taken care of any bot issues?
Yes. Are you still getting the messages?
Yes.
Okay. I have a feeling they should have, because this sounds like one of those Trojans that we were talking about before.
I think she's going to get hit that email.
Is this? But they should have, when they put it back to factory, shouldn't
they? But I don't think it's, see, here's the thing. I don't think it's necessarily on the machine. I think she's just getting, phishing. I think they're phishing.
Yeah, it's
called
phishing. What is this claim to say it's going to do for you when it says you've got a problem with your computer? What does it say?
There's a little button that says fix it now or something like that. I'm driving, so I don't.
Yeah, I wouldn't do that. Don't touch it. If anything, call Comcast.
Well, you've already answered my question. Yeah.
No, go ahead.
Call Comcast directly and say, I'm getting this message, and it keeps coming back and back. I've already had my computer cleaned. Why am I getting this? And have them resolve that for you.
Yeah.
And it's more than likely it's just malicious, and I would ignore them.
But go back, as the guys are saying, go back to Comcast, okay?
Okay.
Get hold of
the
customer service there and say, I had my machine taken back to factory settings, and I'm still getting this nonsense. What is this about? Okay.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And by the way, if you have a question during the week, our Contact Us form on our homepage or the forum is a great place to go. Thank you once again for joining us on this program. I'd like to thank my co-hosts who are here in studio. We have a ball doing the program. It's a lot of fun. And we ought to have a whole program that's just our breaks and our conversations.
I know.
Tips swap back and forth. Good humor as well. Eddie Riddell, Cal Carson, Shane, thank you so much for being here. Delighted to have you guys here. And Shane, you hang out regularly at a computer shop here in suburban Detroit area.
Yes, I do.
Which is?
Comtech Services in Sterling Heights off of Shaner.
Thank you very much. And you can go by and you can see Shane there. And you other guys are the gurus at GM.
You'd be surprised. We get a lot of our listeners come into this. Hey, I was listening to the show. Yeah,
there you go.
Hey, I got one shameless plug real quick.
Please,
the
please.
Motown Winter Blast is going on today.
Oh, that's right, yes.
At 8 o'clock tonight, the New Age Figure Skating Club will be down there doing an exhibition. Come on down and see them. I'll be doing an announcing for them. It's going
to
be a great time.
Oh, you get to announce down there. Winter Blast. I love it. 8 o'clock tonight here in downtown Detroit for those of you who are listening live and can do that.
I'm going to sit home on the couch, watch TV, and I'm going to have a lemonade.
That sounds good, too.
And I'm going to drive my granddaughter out to Ultimate Soccer to have her play soccer, and I'll sit on the sideline and sleep probably.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, guys, I want to make this very quick. On our homepage, we installed something. I found this... Cal remembered it. It was Michigan Connect is the organization. And so what I did was I put up a link there. It says how to find broadband connections in your area. You click on that, it'll take you to the Michigan Connect site, and there they have, you can put in a zip code, and they'll give you a list of the different providers in your area, and then you can do your research on that, okay? It's off our homepage. And it's internetadvisor.net. Go there. It says how to find broadband connection in your area. We also have Valentine's Day for Geeks. Click on that. It's got a fun video in there that you can look at as well. All right. Back to our callers. And let's go to Bill, who is with us from Dearborn. Bill, how you doing on the Internet Advisor?
Oh, I'm doing well. Thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's up?
Well, I have a problem with my HP. I run Vista. And every time I turn my computer off in the evening or I have it at sleep, and when I boot it back up, it wants to reinstall my printer. And I'm on copy 16 of the same printer. It asks for the software to be installed or this, like the CD to install the
right the install
printer.
Disk mm-hmm.
But I don't pay any attention to it. I just hit cancel and somehow reinstalls itself. And
that's interesting. So is this a USB printer?
I'm sorry?
What's the type of printer, and is it USB?
Do you plug it in?
It's HP, and yes, it's plugged in.
Yes, it's plugged in by the USB. Okay.
Okay. Cal, you've had quite a bit of experience with printers.
Bad USB cable, probably. What you're going to want to do is disconnect the cable from the printer, and then go into control panel and delete all of those printers that are configured with in there, those 16 multiple copies.
Really? Is that what causes this? Is a possible bad printer cable?
I think so.
I actually had that happen. I had that happen personally. There was a bad cable.
Why didn't you guys tell me something like this 5 years ago? Jeez, that's great.
I mean, in the past, I've seen it happen this way. Now, I'm not guaranteeing
it did happen to me personally,
yet.
So I know it can't happen.
So unplug it. Delete all those different printer entries in there. Try getting another USB cable and then plug it back in and let it load up the driver. And I think you should be okay.
How much did that USB cable cost them?
Not the power cable, but the USB cable.
The USB.
Correct.
They cost maybe $5. You can find them generically.
Yeah. Don't spend the $25 that some stores will charge
no,
you.
No.
Okay.
And the problem I had had with the computer, the printer I was using, was I was plugging and unplugging it for various reasons. And I had broken something inside of the USB link. That can happen.
Right, and it also could be physically on the port itself, so you might want to try a different port on the computer.
Very good point.
That you could have like a little dust bunny in there. But I like the cable idea better. Shane, you had something?
And Bill, I'm going to give you a big secret here. You're going to owe me one after I tell you this. all your cabling needs, go to MonoPrice, okay?
Go to
MonoPrice.com. That's where you're going to get
MonoPrice.com.
You're going to get the cheapest cable. You get a USB cable for $1.50.
Right, and if you're in the market for HDMI cables, don't spend the $50. You could spend $6 for a 12-foot cable.
Don't buy the gold cables.
The MonoPrice is great for that kind of stuff.
Mono. M-O-N-O, like the disease, price.
Okay.
All right, Bill, thanks a million. All right, let's see if we can get Carlo is with us here from Holland, Ohio. How you doing, Carlo?
Good. How you doing?
Thank you. What can we do for you?
I'm just calling to ask if you can explain to me how pay-per-click works.
Oh, pay per click. Okay.
Yes.
All right. And where are you seeing this pay per click?
Well, it was just an interest that I have in creating a web page and trying to, I guess, profit from that long as I understand and see how it works and see if it's feasible for me to do it.
It's just a Google Ads thing. I mean, if you're going to create a website and you want to drive, you know, customers to that website and put up ads from Google Ads, you know, every time they click on it.
So you would go on a Google site and you would sign up for...
Well, you would own... The way Google's... And you may want to add something to this. The way Google works is you, in your area, you own certain keywords. And when that keyword is clicked, you'll see your ad. And every time they click it, it costs, you know, depending on the word and the location, it costs, you know... a 16th of a penny or, you know, whatever the
so
rate is.
So let's say you're a Zamboni dealer. So anytime somebody would hit Zamboni in the Holland, Ohio area, they would be taken to you.
You will own that right of that name in that area.
And the pay-per-click is, does he pay a certain amount of money to Google for that?
You have an agreement with Google on, okay, I get you're going to give me business, but every time someone clicks that, I'll give you
a penny,
8 cents or 10 cents, you know, whatever it's worth to the person.
So you're paying for advertising. Is there a way that he could put something up where people paid him?
And it goes like that way, too. If you've got a website that generates enough traffic, you can put up your Google ads there, and they will pay you so many cents per click.
Right.
But be careful. You know, don't think you're going to sit there and click and make an income.
A ton of money, yeah.
If you really want to find out more about it, just go to just Google pay per click, and Google actually has a link there, and it explains exactly how the whole process works.
Yeah, you know, if Gary was here, he'd be able to recite it because he probably wrote the book, but and he can give you the history of it all.
But yeah. If you go to Google, and Cal, you said they have a good instructional there. If you go to the Google page, you'll find that, Carlo, and good luck to you with that. Let's see if we can squeeze one more in here, and we have Kurt with us from Chesterfield. Hi, noon, Kurt. A quick question.
Well, I could be better. Hopefully, I will after I talk to you. I have an older Dell laptop, XPS M1710, and it's been at Dell trying to get it fixed for the last month and a half, and unfortunately, every time I call to try to find out what the status is, I can't find anybody that understands my accent.
Lovely.
I was wondering if you guys had a phone number that I could call to try to find out what the heck's going on.
Well, they have your computer now?
Absolutely.
Oh.
Okay. So one of the things Dell has done is they usually have been inundating customers with their emails. After you open a service ticket, they'll just send you all these emails. Have you received any of those emails about the status of your ticket? And
I've gotten one, and you can't reply back to it because it just bounces back.
That's not right. You know, I'm not sure if I can help you with that. I mean, I have corporate numbers that corporations use to dial and Dell.
And there may be a link within that email that he's supposed to click to reply.
Yeah.
Instead of just hitting reply.
When I click on that, it takes me to somewhere, and I put in my service tag number, and then it says, we can't do anything to help you.
Yeah, okay. This sounds like a bigger problem. We're going to put you on hold and see if we can help you a little bit before we go off the air. One of the key things, I think, is if you have the trouble ticket number, as well as your Service Express number, that might be an important thing to have on hand as well. We're going to wrap things up right now, folks. Thank you so much. If you want to get in touch with us with a question of your own, go to internetadvisor.net. You can click on the Contact Us button, put your question in there, send it to us, or you can go into our forums where 24/7 you'll get some folks being there to help you. For right now, thank you very much for having joined us, and for all of my experts in studio and the folks behind the glass, it's been a wonderful week here on the Internet Advisor. See you again soon. You've been listening to a podcast of the Internet Advisor Show, the longest-running, locally produced computer show in Detroit radio. If you'd like to find out more about our weekly show, ask a question of our experts, or find the show notes for this podcast, visit internetadvisor.net. And you'll also find us on Facebook. Thanks for listening.